Right now it is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur joins us on Monday mornings. We talk about food. Of course, you can hear the rebroadcast on the weekend and also at select times right after our 12 noon news. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, let's bring him in, Arthur Schwartz. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning, and it's blessedly cool here for a moment.
We've had eight.
But I want to cool you off.
Okay.
Because I watch too much television, and I've already noticed Christmas commercials.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the shopping stations was selling Christmas ornaments the other day. So this is all playing into what happened to me and made me realize it's time for Christmas. I was looking for a book on my shelves the other day, and I came across this tiny pamphlet. Well, it's not so tiny, but it's more of a pamphlet than a book. It's got, I'm looking now, how many pages, like 50 pages? 48 pages. And it's called Gifts from the Christmas Kitchen. This was beschert, which means meant to be in Yiddish, because only a few days before I found this book, my nephew made me a cocktail, and he said, you're never going to guess what's the base of this cocktail. And the fact is, usually I can. This time I could not. And it was something called Rockin' Rye. He bought this in a bottle in the liquor store. Somebody or other's Rockin' Rye. And he was making a cocktail with it. So I said, oh, that's interesting, because I used to make Rockin' Rye because my grandfather, your great-grandfather, or is it a great-great-grandfather? Great-grandfather. Anyway, back there, Barney Schwartz, who did not drink, by the way, he made Rockin' Rye and had it in a screw-top jar over the sink in the kitchen, in his kitchen, I should add, and I did add in, when I wrote up the recipe, because he was basically the cook in the house. My grandmother always says, I didn't know how to burl an egg until I met your grandfather. My grandmother was not into cooking as a young woman, but later, in later years, she became a very good cook, and she always credited him as being her teacher. And he did, in fact, you know, cook a lot. So, and he was, in fact, at some point in his life, he was, in fact, a cook. He cooked. He made potato salad, coleslaw, pickles. Each one of these, by the way, I could do a whole show on. But today it's Rockin' Rye. So I say, Brian, I used to make Rockin' Rye, and your great grandfather made Rockin' Rye, and so we should make some. So I'm going to make some. I still haven't made it because I was out of rye whiskey.
Isn't that the stuff that has a string in it to hold the?
Yeah, well, that's it.
Okay.
That's the rock part.
Yeah, my grandmother used to make it. Yeah.
There you go, and yeah, it was a cold remedy. Now, I never got it as a kid when I had a cold from my grandfather. And I always remember that jar being pretty full. So I don't know who he gave it to. Maybe he took a nip once in a while. It's sweet. You take, I'll give you, well, anyway, the point is, that was my contribution to this little Christmas book of recipes, Gifts from the Christmas Kitchen, which was published by a woman named Irena Chalmers. Irena was super-duper important in the food world back in the 80s and even 90s, and she only died last year in 2020. And she was, I'm going to go into Irena in a minute, but my recipe for, now I have to give my recipe for Rockin' Rye, because it's so easy anyway. And also, it's July, and who wants to cook, but you can make something. Take, you know, I say in this recipe, attractive, thin-skinned orange. That means an unblemished Florida juice orange. I'm pretty sure that's what my grandfather would have used. You basically need a half of a large one, and you cut that half into wedges. Let's say, I say eighths here, but, you know, probably four wedges is enough. And then a nice lemon, and I say thin-skinned lemon. You know how to tell, this is interesting, I think, because I do choose lemons as for thin-skinned, period. I always want the thin-skinned ones. I don't want to cut the lemon in half and find that it's all pith. And that's, if you look at the the outside. It should the skin should be sort of fine looking, with tiny tiny pores, not sort of rough looking. When next time you go choose lemons, you'll see there's a difference. So anyway, a half of a lemon, and you cut that into wedges, and you put both of these things into a quart jar with, depending on the sweetness you like, 5 to 8 ounces of rock candy. That's the string part, Marshall. It's crystallized sugar on a string.
Yep.
Why that tastes different than just adding sugar, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you could just stir sugar into it or shake sugar into it. Because maybe in the old days, your grandmother's day, my grandfather's day, it was a common thing. I remember rock candy being sold in the candy store on the corner, you know, the luncheonette / candy store, where you bought penny candies. Rock candy was one of them. So 5 to 8 ounces. I think 8 ounces is probably way too much. I would stick with 5 ounces. And then you pour over a whole fifth of rye whiskey. That's 24 ounces, more or less. And you let it sit. And that's it. I mean, after a few days, you can have some. Once the sugar dissolves. So every time you walk by it, you probably should shake it to get this thing going. And that's it. That's rock and rye. Anyway, this book, Gifts from the Christmas Kitchen, I am so happy I found it. It's favorite recipes from, this is the cover says, favorite recipes from 58 famous food writers. So I guess I was a famous food writer in 1983. But on the back cover of the, by the way, the cover of this book was designed by one of the all-time greats of graphic design, Milton Glaser. I do think that Irena had a bit of an affair with Milton Glaser at some point. Irena was notoriously promiscuous. She even tried to get me in bed once. So I know this from firsthand. And by the way, I'm not speaking ill of the dead. Irena would probably love it that I recall all this. And by the way, she, at the end of her life, and she died in her 80s, as I said, just last year, she was the mistress to Joe Baum. This was, everybody knew this. She was Joe Baum's mistress. Joe was married all along, but I don't know how many years, but for years they were partners. So Irena became famous because she had the very brilliant idea of selling cookbooks in gift shops and not just in bookstores. And she published more than 100 titles in this series that I became part of. It was called Irena Chalmers Cookbooks. They are collectible today. There were, as I said, over 100 titles. I may have other ones on my shelf, but I don't know where they are. And they were all sold on racks in gift shops. And the cover of this, I said the cover of this one was Milton Glaser. I don't know if he designed all the covers, but on the back cover of this one are the names of all the food writers who contributed. And I got to say, this is a hall of fame of food writers that Irena put together. Irena was very charming and persuasive, and we all did this for free. We all contributed a recipe to her book for free. She made some money on us, but, you know, nobody seemed to care. It was what she did. And you know what? There are a number of recipes here that I want to cook, and one that I did cook yesterday. And that's from an old friend of mine, an adorable woman named Anna Teresa Callan. We say Teresa because she was Italian. She wasn't Teresa. She was Anna Teresa. Everybody called her Anna Teresa. Anna Teresa was somewhat old. I mean, let me just say that I was a kid in 1983, more or less. I was in my mid-30s. And a lot of the established, as this book says, most famous food writers were significantly older than me. So a significant number of these people are not here anymore. And Anna Teresa died in her mid-80s. must be, it's more than 10 years ago, probably in, like, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. I was one of the eulogists at her memorial service, so I should remember this, but I don't. Anna Theresa lived on West 12th Street in Greenwich Village when I came to know her in the mid-70s, but she died in Italy in her beloved Abruzzo. She was from Abruzzo, and this story always reminds me of an incident that actually happened to me. I was in a little town in southern Italy, and I was with a small group of tourists, my group, on a little tour, having lunch in this little town where I had a friend who had a great restaurant, even though it was a tiny town. And we were walking around town and causing some interest among the local people, and this little man attached himself to me and, speaking in English, was telling me what I was looking at in town. And I finally turned to him and I said, "Excuse me, sir, but you speak perfect English. How is that if you're from Nusco?" And he said, "Well, I was born in Nusco, and I'm going to die in Nusco, but in between I lived in Long Island City." So that was Anna Theresa. She was born in Abruzzo, she wanted to die in Abruzzo, and she did, but in between she lived on West 12th in Greenwich Village. And she was married to Harold Callan. Anna Theresa, I don't remember her maiden name, but Anna Theresa married Harold Callan, I guess around 1960. They were significantly older than me. And Harold was a very well-established playwright who wrote mainly for TV, and so I think he did a couple movies, too. And he was produced in New York. And when I met him, he was a professor, playwright, playwriting professor at NYU, and then at the New School, which was just a few doors down from where they lived on West 12th Street. West 12th Street in those days was a very interesting street, besides the New School being there, having started there. It was the food writer street. Bert Green lived on West 12th Street with his partner, Philip Stephen Schultz. Mimi Sheridan still lives on West 12th Street. At the end of West 12th Street, where it meets Hudson, was Liddy Marshall, who has a... By the way, Bert Green has a recipe in this book. Philip Schultz has a recipe in this book. Liddy Marshall is in this book, along with Anna Theresa. Some of our listeners may remember Jane Butel. She's still kicking, and she's the president. I don't know if she still has her spice company, but she had a... I should look this up. She had a. She basically made Southwest food a thing, a regional cuisine that everybody looked to. And Jacques Pepin, who, by the way, if you go on Facebook, has been running for months and months now, a very quickie recipe demonstration produced by his daughter. And you can look up Jacques Pepin on Facebook. There's a wealth of stuff there, including a salad dressing I'm going to make this week, a cream dressing from his mother, who I once met. Anyway, everybody's in here. But Anna Theresa, was a very special person to me, and I know a lot about her, including this wonderful tidbit. She confided in me and Bob once, because this was something that she was taught to be embarrassed about, but wasn't really. She was Miss Abruzzo, 1951. And she was a teenager. She was 18 or 19. This was the beauty contest that led to Miss Italy, that led to Miss Universe. And Anna Theresa was a Ingrid Bergman lookalike, even in her older age. I don't want to say old age, because she never looked old. Even in her older age, she was quite a beauty. And, a fascinating, charming woman as well. In any case, she was Miss Abruzzo, and when her father found out that she'd entered the beauty con, they were not poor people. They were a very educated, upper-middle-class family. And he was so embarrassed by her being in a beauty contest, which he viewed, as she said, something only for poor girls to do so they could get ahead in life on their beauty. He forbid her to continue in the contest. So she never got to Miss Italy, but she was a beauty. Anyway, Anna Teresa contributed a recipe that is relatively keto-friendly, meaning it has a minimal amount of starch in it, of carbohydrates in it. I was so curious about it, I had to make it right away, and I did yesterday. And she calls it rustic pizza in broth. That is not what she would have called it. That was what Irena called it. In this, she was the publisher, she got her way, she called rustic pizza in broth, but it's pizza rustica in brodo. And what does this mean? Pizza rustica in Italian doesn't mean rustic pizza. It means savory pizza, because there is pizza dolce, meaning sweet pizza, meaning like a pie, or a tart, or a crostata. But pizza rustica is a savory pie, and it could be a lot of different things, meaning I have one in the southern Italian table, for instance, that is just cheese and eggs and baked in a pastry crust. And it's a particular one from a particular place, and in the end it sort of tastes like quiche. But most pizza rustica have diced cheese and or salumi, meaning salami, ham, cooked ham, cured ham like prosciutto, like that. And this one has no crust, so that's what intrigued me, is she bakes this in the oven as a custard and then cuts it into squares and puts it in broth. I happen to have some really good homemade broth in the freezer, so I didn't mind having broth yesterday when it was so hot. But in my air-conditioned apartment, it was okay. But I did have to turn the oven on yesterday morning to make this. But we didn't eat it until later in the day, and it was fine, made in the morning and eaten later in the day. In fact, I'm sure it would have been eaten a good even today. So this is the recipe for Anna Teresa Callan's pizza rustica in brodo, served in broth. I'll get to my little variation possibility later. But it's an easy recipe. 6 eggs. And you beat them. I used my handy Swedish whisk, that flat whisk, but just beat them with a whisk or with a large fork until they get nice and mixed and creamy even, you know, a little thickened, slightly thickened. And then continue to beat in 6 tablespoons of melted butter, and melted and then cooled. I prepped everything, by the way, earlier and then just mixed it all together and put it in the oven. I think you should put it in the oven sort of. Oh, I should tell you, I preheated the oven to 375, and as Anna Teresa said, I baked it in a 9 by 12 inch baking dish, which I always call a 9 by 13. I actually remeasured my dish the other day when I did this, and it depends where you're measuring, if it's 9 by 13 or 9 by 12. So anyway, that size, that Pyrex dish that almost everybody has, and she had, obviously. So you beat 6 eggs, beat in 6 tablespoons of cooled melted butter, 6 tablespoons, she has, grated pecorino romano cheese. Now, Anna Teresa was from Abruzzo, where pecorino, sheep's milk cheese, is the most common cheese, because the most common animal in Abruzzo are sheep. In fact, it is sheep-herding country. It's mountainous. I don't want to go into the whole sheep culture of Abruzzo, but it's a sheep culture. So, of course, they use sheep's milk cheese. I did not. I did not have any pecorino in the house. I did have perfectly good Parmigiano-Reggiano, actually very good Parmigiano-Reggiano. So I used that as my grated cheese. Then she has you put in 6 tablespoons of flour, 6 tablespoons of milk. Next time I make this, and I will because it was delicious, I'm going to reduce the flour. I mean, not only because I'm trying to avoid carbs, but also because I don't think you really needed it. I think six eggs will, with all the cheese in here, six tablespoons of milk can do is fine. And then, so you beat all of that together. By the way, I followed on today's directions. I beat the eggs, the butter, and the six tablespoons of grated cheese together. And then I alternated the flour and the milk, meaning I put in a little flour, I beat in a little milk, I put in a little flour, I beat that in, until I used up both. And then I stirred in the final ingredients, which is really what, you know, the pièce de résistance, is five tablespoons of diced prosciutto. Now, I went the easy route here, and I bought, in a box, and sold in almost every supermarket these days, boxed, diced prosciutto. Five tablespoons of that is not even a half a box, which is a box is 4 ounces usually. So this was not even 2 ounces of prosciutto. If you're dicing your own prosciutto, if you feel like doing that, you're going to need about 2 ounces of prosciutto. And then three tablespoons of grated fontina cheese. Not a cheese I usually buy, but I did for this recipe. And I bought one that looked good from Wisconsin, not real Italian fontina. That's hard to find, by the way. But fontina, by definition, is a good melting cheese. So even when they make it in Wisconsin, it is a very good melting cheese. And it has a little tang to it, but not much. A little flavor and a little salt. And because I use Parmigiano and not salty pecorino, I put in a half a teaspoon of salt. I even could not resist putting in some freshly ground pepper. And you pour all that into your buttered 9x12-inch baking dish, and you put it in a larger roasting pan, and you fill up the roasting pan, you know, at least above the line of the egg in the pan, and put it in a boiling water. I had the water just boiled in your 375-degree oven. Now, Anna Teresa says to bake this for 10 to 15 minutes. No way. Until the pizza is set and the toothpick inserted in the middle comes out clean. No way is this going to be done in 15 minutes. I left mine in for 18 minutes, and truth be told, it was not enough. I think 20 or even maybe 22 minutes would have been better. Of course, you open the oven at 375 and you pour in this boiling water in your bain-marie, your larger roasting pan, and you're reducing the temperature in there. And mine, by the way, looked done, and I poked in my cake tester and it seemed okay, but the middle was not okay. The sides were okay, but in any case, next time I bake it, I'm going to bake it in a smaller pan, and I'm not going to be afraid to leave it in the oven a long time. I'm going to do it in a 9-inch square instead of the 9x12, because in the end, after you let it cool, you want to cut this into little squares and put it in a bowl with your hot broth. And these were thin squares. I want cubier squares, cubes, instead of thin squares. So next time I'm going to make it deeper, I'm going to bake it longer, and I'm sure it's going to come, and I'm going to reduce the flour. I always like to make a recipe exactly as written the first time. I think that's a good rule. It depends, of course. You know, sometimes I can see a glaring error, but I want to make this anyway. This, nothing glared at me except the lack of salt and pepper, and then I realized, well, you use salty pecorino romano, you don't need salt, and I'm not sure why Anna Teresa didn't tell you to put a little pepper in, but I did. I have such fond memories of this lady, and I have to say that when I read her obit this morning, written by Florence Fabricant in the Times, and I know Florence was, well, at least she was friendly with Anna Teresa Callan, a lot of the quotes that Florence gave were from a friend of mine, Nick Malgieri. Nick is a pastry chef and baking teacher and has written numerous baking books. I think he's still writing another book. He moved to Brooklyn a few years ago, and we have a date to go eat dim sum together here in Brooklyn. The dim sum restaurants here have reopened, I'm reporting. You know, that's a big social thing for Chinese people. The place that Nick and I are going to go to, we'd probably be the only, with Bob and maybe one other friend, the only Caucasians there. And I'm sure the Chinese community here in Brooklyn is celebrating that the restaurants are opening again. Nick, I'm going to talk to Nick about Anna today. He was a very close friend of hers. Who else is in this book? It's unbelievable. My friend Suzanne, here's a recipe that I'm going to make. My friend Suzanne Hamlin, who I talk to regularly, meaning even more than, I would say, several times a week, we both have time on our hands. She has a recipe in here. She's from Louisville, Kentucky. She's lived in New York, for, I don't know, 60 years. But she's kept her accent and she's kept her Louisville-ness. And she likes being from Louisville, but she likes living in New York. She lived in Brooklyn for many, many years. And then she moved up to Newburgh, and now she's back in Manhattan. But she contributed a recipe for Louisville lemon bars. Now, I remember Suzanne was one of these people who, when she couldn't sleep, she would get into the kitchen and bake. And we worked together for 20 whatever years. I was her boss, her editor. And I knew when Suzanne was having sleeping problems when she was bringing baked goods into the office. So one of the chief ones that I liked was her Louisville lemon bars. And she always disparaged everybody else's lemon bars as not being the real deal. So I'm going to make hers. And the other thing in here is this. I had a laugh. You know, some people's personalities come out in their recipes. So a woman, I'm not going to even mention her name, but a woman who I strongly dislike has a recipe in this Christmas book. It's by far the most complicated recipe in the book. It's for pâtés, but it wasn't enough for her to make pâté en croûte, or not en croûte. Is it en croûte? No, it's not even en croûte. Anyway, it's the only two-page recipe in the book, and it's something I would never make. On the other hand, there are other recipes that jump out at me as something I must make. And some people took this seriously about it being gifts from the Christmas kitchen, and they gave recipes for things like the lemon bars, I guess you could put in a tin and give as a gift. But Natalie Dupree, who is now in her mid-80s and very active on Facebook, gave a pepper jelly. Now, Natalie, who remains a friend of mine, Natalie was an army brat. So she lived sort of everywhere, but she was really from New Jersey. And then she moved to Atlanta and became Miss Food in Atlanta. She started, I have to say, one of the first big time cooking schools in those days. We're talking about the 70s. Department stores, in order to sell cookware and et cetera, often had demonstrators, but they didn't have full blown cooking schools. Natalie, I forget the name of the department store in Atlanta, started a full-blown cooking school. And, you know, Natalie's a very outgoing woman to this day, and she got very active in Atlanta. Eventually, she became Miss Atlanta, even though she grew up in New Jersey. Now, she most recently was Miss Charlottesville. Not Charlottesville. What's on the coast? Charlottesville. And now she just moved somewhere else down there, but she's real Southern. I always say from Southern New Jersey. In fact, in 1983, when this book was published, she was credited as the author of Cooking of the South. Oh, here it is, Rich's Cooking School, Rich's Department Store. She started this cooking school in Rich's Department Store. Well, Natalie's most recent book is called Mastering the Art of Southern Cooking. My only criticism, and this is an enormous book. I mean, I don't know how many pages, maybe 600 pages, It's a coffee table unto itself. My only criticism of this book is that it's not what I would think of as a Yankee, as strictly Southern cuisine. She's sort of got some French stuff in there, Italian, I don't know. A lot of stuff that is not traditional Southern cooking, but is made in the South. So, and maybe sometimes has a Southern U.S. ingredient.